court already ruled in favor of this legislation?
Absolutely. The legislation was passed in 2021. There was an intentional two-year ramping up period because it is a significant change. At the last second, there was essentially an injunction filed. It went through the process from January of 2023 to September of 2023. The Illinois Supreme Court found it to be constitutional, and we have 2 years essentially of success of this policy. Yet and still, Trump is playing politics, not caring about the people of Cook County, Chicago. And again, it's another step in destabilizing the city. We've seen community violence intervention dollars, things that help drop the murder rate, being stripped away, defunded from our communities. And this will also hurt communities, as we know that jail, especially inappropriate jail, reduces the criminological factors or increases the criminological factors that bring people back into the criminal legal system. People can't get jobs, people can't get education, and they resort to things that we don't like because the system intentionally starves them of the resources they need to contribute to our communities.
Sharon, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to look at the story. Sharon Mitchell, Jr., Chief Cook County Public Defender, part of the coalition that helped support the bill to remove money from the bail process. Thanks also to Chicago Alderperson Byron Sigcho Lopez, Alderperson of the 25th Ward in Chicago and Chair of the Housing and Real Estate Committee of the Chicago City Council. We will continue to follow these stories and what happens on Labor Day. This is Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaru Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Safwat Nizal. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland.
KBOO's loud and proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
In the face of a rogue fascist president, there's also some new energy coming from the left. Look to New York City and Zoran Mandani. This history of a similar mayoral run in Los Angeles in the early 20th century. Stay tuned. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
New York City is like no other place on earth. Politically, they've known Donald Trump for decades as a greedy real estate titan who discriminated against people of color. The Big Apple has enthusiastically not liked Mr. Trump because they've known who he is. And something big politically is now happening in that city. And a real shocker to the Democratic establishment, Democratic Socialist Zohan Mamdani beat their extremely well-funded candidate, Andrew Cuomo, not by a little, but by a big margin. That was in the primary. Now it's on to the general election in November. Our guest today, Fred Glass, in an article in the Stansbury Forum and Portside, writes an article called What California History Has to Say About the New York City Mayor's Race. There's a similar candidate, apparently, 114 years ago in another big American city. And he says if Mandani loses, the leadership of the Democratic Party will redouble its push to field empty neoliberal suits in 2026. And we've seen all too often how well that works. It doesn't. Looking to history, Glass notes that Democratic Socialist Job Harriman's defeat in Los Angeles in 1911 set back the cause of working class politics for decades. Well, if Democrats once again fail to connect with and inspire the working class, the party will only have itself to blame, and the fate of our noble Republican experiment, that's Republican with a small r, may then be on an irreversible course toward failure. Some of us are not giving up. So the whole world is now looking to New York City. And this race is more than just a bellwether. The future of not just the party, but America itself is at stake. Will the Democratic Party once again, as it has in the past, stand for working people? Can a grassroots movement of the young and those millions who struggle with rising cost of living beat the party machine and elect Mamdani as its next mayor? One thing I've learned from history is that we never learn from history. But the opportunity is there, and that's what we'll discuss on today's Keeping Democracy Alive. Fred Glass, thank you so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive. It's a heavy lift. We're all needed.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Bert.
Fred Glass is the author of From Mission to Microchip, A History of the California Labor Movement. He's former communications director of the California Federation of Teachers. After retiring in 2017, Fred Glass taught night classes in labor history at City College of San Francisco until 2023. He wrote and directed Golden Lands, Working Hands, a 10-part video series on the history of the California labor movement shown on public television stations in that state and distributed to every public high school in California. In addition, he wrote and directed a short animated cartoon with the voice of the late, sadly missed, Ed Asner. Tax the Rich, an animated fairy tale, which received 1 million YouTube views on 2012 and was the subject of an unhappy Fox News commentary. As he notes, a socialist in the top municipal office, the idea sent the LA ruling class into a freakout. Sounds like New York, and the same ruling class freaked out again in 1934 with the California gubernatorial campaign of the author of The Jungle, Upton Sinclair, known as Uppy. Neither of the two won. Could this history be a predictor of what's ahead for Mamdani? As time goes on, we will find out. Okay, Fred, thanks again for being with us. Please tell us about this Democratic Socialist candidate for Los Angeles mayor back in 1911.
Joe Behrman was the leading labor attorney in Los Angeles. He was the attorney for the Central Labor Council, and he was a perpetual candidate for office for the Socialist Party, which in the early years of the 20th century was hitting its peak around the time he ran for mayor in 1911. He was the vice presidential candidate alongside of Eugene V. Debs, the president in 1900.
All right.
And then he was running for various LA and California offices after that. And he was one of the leaders in the National Party for the fusion approach, which called upon socialists to work closely with the labor movement in order to build a practical, broad-based approach to socialism in America. So he was considered to be in the middle to the right of the Socialist Party at that time. Uh-huh. As a social democrat, he wasn't one of the ultras. He was not calling for revolution now. He believed that revolution would be possible sometime in the future when a big enough mass movement had been built. At that time, Los Angeles was the second biggest city in California. It was considerably smaller than San Francisco, but it was growing rapidly. In 1900, it had about 100,000 people in it, and by 1910, it had grown, tripled in size to about 300,000. Mm-hmm. So that's the size it was when he was running. And the labor movement was afflicted in Los Angeles with one of the most reactionary ruling classes in the country. The Los Angeles Times was run by Harrison Gray Otis, who was violently anti-labor. Mm-hmm. He was head of the Merchants and Manufacturers Association, which was basically a club of business owners, big business owners who wished to keep working class people in peonage. And he was, of course, very unhappy that Harriman was running, and he was one of the lead freakouts when Harriman came in first in an open primary in October of 1911. So what Harriman stood for was pretty close to what Zoran Mondami is now running on in New York. He had plans to expand public services. He wanted to take private services offered by large corporations such as the streetcars and municipalize them. He wanted to make Los Angeles, in essence, a more affordable city for working people. And he proposed to do this with a small tax on the wealthy and on businesses. So very similar to the program that Mamdani is running on in New York right now, which is no surprise because we're still living in capitalism and the socialist solution to these problems are the same. We want to make things more affordable for working people, and we'd like the rich to help out by handing over some of their ill-gotten gains. It's not going to hurt their lifestyles in the least to give us 2 or 3% of what they make, and it'll help all the rest of us. But that's a bridge too far for most of them.
And it certainly is a very interesting time. We have Donald Trump, the orange one, coming out really freaking out against Mondani, of course. And he actually seems to be really open about wanting an oligarchy to run everything, to replace democracy with an oligarchy. Really straightforward. Now, of course, the Socialist Party was big. It was quite, you know, common and accepted, no big deal then. I mean, nowadays, usually or oftentimes, it seems to be changing, I must say, that traditionally in the last 20 years or so, people, when they hear the word socialist, as soon as they hear the word, they stop thinking. What was the Democratic Party at the time? He was not the Democratic Party nominee, correct?
No, that's right. He was running on the Socialist Party line. And the Democratic Party was a mixed bag at that time. I'd say much like it is today, although the right wing of the Democratic Party was much more in evidence at that time. Today we have a right wing that's right wing, for instance, on international issues. And it has a veneer of being more progressive through identity politics. But, you know, the Democratic Party then as now is split between a progressive wing and a less progressive wing, a centrist wing. And but at that time, because of the proximity to the Civil War and the legacy of the Civil War and the Democratic Party's ascendancy in the South, things were a little bit different in terms of the mix of politics in the party than they are now. And the racist wing of the party was much more prominent at that time.
Yes. I mean, if you were a racist at that time, chances are you were a Democrat. That's the reality.
That's right, because the Republicans were still, although it was changing, still believed to be the party of Lincoln.
Yes.
And so African Americans particularly tended to vote Republican at that time, although that was beginning to change. But still, that was stirrings beneath the surface, and African Americans pretty much voted Republican then. And what Harriman was doing and the socialist slate was doing was addressing that. The first African-American candidate for city council was running at that time on his slate. So there were things that were beginning to change around racial politics in this election.
And it's true, if you were a progressive or liberal back then, chances are you would vote socialist. That was very common. What was it? How did Job Harriman rise up? I mean, what was his background? He was elected to a few things?
He ran for a few things. He was not elected, although he came close to a couple of municipal offices. His background was that he was a preacher in the Midwest. And he had TB, and like many at that time, in the 1890s, he came out to Los Angeles for his health and stayed. And as an attorney, he gravitated toward, you know, he was a gospel kind of socialist. And he, the Socialist Party had a pretty large Christian wing at that time. Christian socialism probably made up a quarter to a third of the party. And so he fit right into that and came out of that.
Fascinating. Yes, and people forget that the Midwest had Bob La Follette fighting Bob La Follette, who was quite progressive, certainly a left-leaning populist who was a U.S. senator. There's a strong tradition in America of left populism. I mean, you know, they want us to forget history, and the Orange One wants to erase history entirely, and they're doing a lot of that. Well, 1911... way before TV and, of course, social media. It was also, I believe, before radio reached into every household. In that context, Fred, if you could please tell us about the power of the LA Times and their editorial involvement in the race for mayor.
The LA Times was not shy about its anti-labor bias. And it was the center of the messaging operation against socialism, the labor movement, and Harriman's campaign. So, you know, there were other daily newspapers at the time. There was one that was more liberal, the Herald, which was a, it was hoping that it could get a larger audience in the working class by taking pro-working class positions for a while in the 1900s. But the LA Times was by far the largest circulation. And the, you know, the other form of media was public speaking. And so you had soapboxing on street corners and in the parks and in meetings. And so the Harriman campaign was building larger and larger local Harriman clubs. The membership of the Socialist Party was surging. The meetings were growing larger and larger. And this was very much worrisome to Harrison Gray Otis and the LA Times. The other alternative to the LA Times and newspapers of mainstream media was the labor press. And so the Socialist Party and the labor movement had their own newspapers. And they didn't have the reach of the LA Times, but they certainly reached the membership of the party and of the unions. And the relationship between the unions and the Socialist Party at this point in time was very close. The Socialist Party offices were in the same building that had been built by the Los Angeles Labor Council. It was a skyscraper, meaning it was seven stories tall. And they worked very closely together in the campaign. So this was another sign for the ruling class of the danger involved here, because they've been working very hard to pass anti-labor rules. There was anti-picketing regulations on the books passed by passed by the Merchants and Manufacturers controlled city council and signed by the mayor. So the class lines were very clearly drawn going into this campaign.
Not like, you know, in the 50s, we, believe it or not, young people don't know we had a strong middle class, a working class. It was really strong, and there were a lot of us. And an old friend of mine and somebody who will be on this show again in the future, Michael Kazin, wrote a book called What It Took to Win, about a the last 150 years or so of the Democratic Party, and he pointed out one of the main themes was that movements, there has to be a movement, either civil rights movement or labor movement. We don't see that now, but in California at the time, the labor movement was really quite strong. What interests, well, I guess it's fairly obvious what interests fought against the unions, but what were the labor unions? Did they work together? Were there like agricultural workers and industrial workers, or was there one big union?
In 1911, the industrial workers of the world had been around for a half dozen years. That was the one.
No, still quite new.
Yes, that was the one big union.
Yes.
And it was organizing in California. And as you mentioned, Bert, agricultural workers were being organized by the IWW,
right,
which was pretty unusual. The AFL, because most agricultural workers in California were immigrant workers of color, the unions were mostly not so interested. And while they were strong in San Francisco was perhaps the strongest labor town in the country at that point in time. Los Angeles was much less so. It was, the labor movement was growing, assisted by their siblings in San Francisco who had sent down organizers to help out. But the labor movement in LA was not quite at that point. The one time that something had happened where the AFL, American Federation of Labor, Central Labor Council, had helped with farm worker organizing was in 1903 in Oxnard, when beet workers went on strike, Mexican and Japanese immigrant beet workers. And they won, partially with the assistance of the Los Angeles Labor Council, encouraged by Fred Wheeler, who was a comrade in the Socialist Party with Joe Perriman. And he himself had run for mayor earlier and was ultimately, he was on the ticket in 1911 as a city council member. And while he lost, like Harriman did in 1911, by 1913, he won the first city council seat for a socialist in L.A. And so he was the organizer sent to help out with the beet workers. But this was unusual for that time.
Right.
The IWW, because it was interested in organizing everybody from top to bottom of any work site, they were basically a civil rights movement at the same time as a labor movement. And the AFL was different. There were some unions that were stronger in the direction of racial fairness and organizing workers of color, but most of the AFL was not.
Right.
It was sadly, because it was a craft union oriented labor movement, it only organized workers one craft at a time and was pretty officially disinterested, most of the unions, in organizing workers of color. So that let out the farm workers.
Yeah, interesting these days how the Trump regime is pretty openly making war on people of color and anybody to the left, that's for sure. If you just tuned in, dear listener, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive, and it's a heavy lift. We need everybody involved. Our guest today is Fred Glass, who's written a very interesting article. The Trump administration wants to erase history, but Fred, you know a lot about history in California in particular, and he wrote an article called What California History Has to Say About the New York City Mayor's Race, and we can learn from that. You say, and I do find it fascinating, I did not know that Harriman was on the ticket with Eugene Debs, who was really a great American who drew big crowds, and that the soapbox at the time, I believe, I mean, in the 19th and early 20th century, it was entertainment. There was no radio, nothing like that. I mean, the people went there for entertainment. Is that accurate? I mean, they do big crowds.
Yes, Harriman was renowned for his oratorical skills. He was a courtroom lawyer and was quite persuasive and in all the major cities at this time. if you were going to be running for office, you had to be a good public speaker. And you had to be able to take hecklers and neutralize them. And this was, you know, no television, no internet, no radio. The motion picture industry was still in its infancy.
Right.
And so public speaking was a major form of entertainment.
Oh, fascinating. And I can just imagine that. You say it wasn't Job Harriman's platform which actually caused his defeat. We've all heard of October surprises. What was that era's October surprise?
Harriman had started off, before he ran for mayor, taking on the defense of the McNamara brothers, John and James McNamara. Uh-huh. John was one of the leaders of the National Iron Workers Union. Jim was often employed for various tasks by the iron workers. The iron workers, for close to a decade at this point, had been running an underground bombing campaign against the Iron Workers Bosses Association.
Oops.
And the reason why, in this early era of industrial unionism, was because the bosses were there were no labor laws, national labor laws to protect organizing. Mm-hmm. And so the bosses were free to hire thugs to beat the hell out of any union organizers. And iron workers, physical men, were not inclined to take this line down. And they were, therefore, running a campaign to blow up the buildings that the iron workers were working on if the employers were utilizing these kinds of violent tactics against them. And up until that time, these bombings were mysterious. They happened at night. The buildings were wrecked, but nobody was ever hurt in any of this explosions, in any of the explosions, until 1910, when they miscalculated and blew up the LA Times. And this was the first time they had turned to a an actually operating building. I may be wrong about that. I think there was some an ironworks maybe that was already in operation also around Los Angeles. But in any case, nobody had ever been hurt in any of these bombings. But this time there was a miscalculation. It took place early in the morning. There were 20 workers in the building that were killed. And so Harriman believed that the McNamara brothers, the McNamara brothers were chased down and they were on the run, and they were kidnapped by the operatives of the Burns Agency, which was a security firm utilized by bosses in industrial disputes all around the country. They got the McNamara brothers and brought them back to face trial in L.A. A couple of years before, Clarence Darrow had been brought in to defend leaders of the Mine Workers Union, Western Federation of Miners, who had been accused of bombing the governor's house in Idaho, I believe. Might have been Colorado, but I think it was Idaho. And he, like Harriman, believed the McNamara brothers were innocent, like the Western Federation of Miners leaders, it turned out. Unfortunately, they were not.
Right.
And so when Harriman decided to run for mayor, Darrow was brought in to replace him defending the McNamara brothers. And at that point on, Harriman had very little contact. After briefing Darrow and handing over the files, he was then running for mayor and was out of the loop in terms of the trial. But once Darrow found out that they were guilty, he then realized he had, and they had the goods on him, he realized they had to switch their plea to guilty. And because Darrow was passionately committed against capital punishment. He was willing to trade their changing their plea 4 days before the election. That was part of the deal. That had to happen, you know, right before the election, in order to save their lives, switch the plea to guilty and to have prosecution not ask for the death penalty, instead life imprisonment. So that was the deal that was made. Nobody told Merriman until it was announced. And the entire socialist slate, which had been poised to sweep to victory, went down to defeat.
Yeah, there was violence was not uncommon then, and people remembered back in 1911 the infamous Chicago Haymarket bombing of 1886. It wasn't that long before then when labor leaders were blamed and seven labor leaders were sentenced to death and one to a term of 15 years in prison. Even though they were not guilty, the accused were found guilty, all but one were innocent. But this time, he did plead guilty. They, too, pleaded guilty just before the election. Even though Harriman had nothing to do with it, you know, it's like nowadays, as we said earlier on, you know, when people hear the word socialist, they stop thinking. Even though he had nothing to do with it, how did that conviction affect the campaign? What was it looking like up until that point?
The single largest march and demonstration in LA history had been the march in defense of the McNamara brothers. Everybody believed that, except for the people who actually knew the details, everybody believed that they were being framed. And this was quite common at the time.
Yes, it was.
And so it was not hard to believe that they were being framed in this case as well. 25,000 people marched by their jail cells and had an enormous rally for Harriman and for their for freedom for the McNamara brothers. So the campaign, because Harriman had been their initial defense attorney, you know, he was just very closely connected in the public mind. And it was a winning strategy in terms of public opinion until the moment that they pled guilty.
So his what he stood for was popular, was doing really well. The momentum, as I understand it, was with Job Harriman at the time until that disastrous conviction. So he was standing for maybe similar things that Zoran Mondani is standing for, having a small tax on the rich, making things more affordable for people. And, you know, there was a back then, you know, it was still the Gilded Age, which doesn't compare to today's Gilded Age, actually, when, you know, the robber barons, the oligarchs ran everything. And there was great sympathy for the working class. There were a lot of people in the working class and not that many people in the oligarchy. So it seemed to be something that was really happening. And in California, in interesting place, in the 1934 Democratic campaign, there was Democratic Socialist Upton Sinclair. He waged a strong campaign for governor. What can you tell us about that race? Were there similarities to the Harriman campaign?
Well, it was quite similar. I would like to say one more thing about the impact of the loss of the Harriman campaign.
Yes.
Which was it set back the cause of working class politics and labor organizing in Los Angeles for a couple decades. We then were firmly after that in LA into the open shop period, which was a time when the labor movement was on the defensive, and where even in San Francisco, the stronghold in California of the labor movement, unions suffered defeat after defeat. And the conditions for workers deteriorated greatly. So that was the situation up until the Great Depression. And, you know, there's no guarantee that something like an economic depression and being pushed to the wall is going to make anybody a radical. But by the early 1930s, that radicalization was in fact happening, both because of the terrible conditions, but also because especially people were organizing at that time. And there was a resurgence of interest in the Socialist Party, the Communist Party, which was a split from the Socialist Party around World War One and its aftermath, also gaining members. And in both California and New York, both parties were experiencing a renewed interest and growth because they were offering solutions to the problems of the Great Depression that mainstream politicians were not. And within the labor movement, that interest was growing as well, and especially the kind of organizing that it would take to help working people stand together, move past their demoralization and the conditions they found themselves in with a sense of solidarity. So Upton Sinclair, who had been, you know, of course, closely identified with socialism through his writings all through the years, that people usually think of Upton Sinclair in relationship to his most famous book, right, The Jungle, published in the early 1900s about the meatpacking industry. My personal favorite of his novels was Oil. Later, just recently, I guess in the last maybe 10 years, made into a Hollywood movie, There Will Be Blood, which wasn't quite as radical as the book was, but the book gives you a pretty good sense of what it was like to be an industrial worker in the open shop period. So he read the political scene and left the Socialist Party, but did not leave Socialist Party politics, and decided to run on the Democratic Party line. And in the primary in 1934, he came out first. And so he was poised, like Harriman had been in L.A., to be elected, in his case, governor of California. So you then have the same kind of panic in the ruling class, except now it's the California-wide ruling class. The most, I guess, notorious tactic that they embraced was having the Hollywood movie studios produce a series of newsreels that were all scripted and acted, but purported to be factual documentaries about things like, they had interviews with men and women in the street about the campaign, and you would have people with, you know, 4 days growth of beard saying things like, in a foreign accent, Sinclair was the author of the Russian Revolution, and it worked out well there, and it's going to work out well here. Or you have scenes of hobos jumping off of trains coming into California from around the country, and interviews with them where they talk about they're going to live the fat life now in California once Sinclair is elected. So that tactic was very effective. By now, 20 years later, after the Harriman campaign, of course, motion pictures and radio were solidly established. And these shown in every single movie theater in California, the deal was you could not show any of your feature films or cartoons or the rest of the program. It's a whole package, unless you also included the anti-Sinclair newsreels. So every single movie theater showed these again and again. So you had also this campaign featured what was really the first comprehensive media campaign. It was, you know, the They planted stories in all the newspapers, which the newspaper publishers were all too happy to run, all about stories of how Sinclair was going to become the new Stalin in California.
Mm-hmm.
And so the left was really unprepared to deal with a campaign on this scale. And despite the fact that he was quite popular within the labor movement and working class suburbs, he did lose the campaign.
One of the first times that fear was employed, and one of the things I've learned in politics is one of the most powerful weapons in politics is fear. And the guys we have in there now use it very effectively. Fear of the other. Fear is just so powerful. You can twist things, and those newsreels coming across as reality, they could do that back then, and people didn't know.
It did tap into, xenophobic threads in the ideological discourse of the state and the country at that time. This was also around the time that hundreds of thousands of Mexican immigrants and also Mexicans who had become citizens were repatriated to Mexico in California.
Wow.
This was one of the reactions to the Great Depression, where right-wing politicians were, as you say, preying upon people's fears and very effectively pointing at scapegoats in order to draw attention away the people who had created the Great Depression, which was the greed of the capitalists who overproduced and
It was just runaway, uncontrolled, wild gambling with a huge amount of money. Then it all fell to pieces because there was no real solid base for it. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. I'm pleased to have our guest today, Fred Glass, who was a former communications director of the California Federation of Teachers, and he's written an article, What California History Has to Say About the New York City Mayor's Race. Now, on to the 21st century that we're well into. Mondami winning the Democratic nomination, sure freaked out the party establishment. This is the same establishment that spent oodles of money in 2016, making sure their chosen one, Hillary Clinton, would be the nominee over Democratic Socialist Bernie Sanders, who was also extremely popular and drew big crowds. Like Harriman, Mondani is openly a Democratic Socialist. What do you think he has going for him that may well prove victorious, as long as there's no bombing incident 4 days before?
Yeah, I think short of October surprise, he's going to win. And the reason why is because he's offering the message that the Democratic Party was supposed to offer as the party of the worker in 2016 that Hillary Clinton completely failed to offer. I mean, it should have been clear. The Bernie Sanders gained more votes for president in the Democratic Party primaries, some 13 million. Percentage-wise, that was way more than Eugene Debs did in his most successful campaign. He got about 6%, and Bernie had about 10% of the total votes. And the fact that it was such a popular message was completely obscured by the neoliberal establishment of the Democratic Party. It's complicated because post Citizens United, you need a lot of money in order to compete in a presidential campaign or any campaign, really. However, in focusing on raising the money and in going after the big billionaire donors, the Democratic top leadership unfortunately allowed the pro-worker part of its traditional messaging to evaporate. And if Bernie showed anything, it was the importance of that, if not front and center, at least as a strong thread within the messaging. And Clinton did none of that, just not at all.
Yeah.
And Mamdani is placing that front and center, as he should. And I think that, you know, we'll see come election day whether all the smears and all of the usual messaging that's employed by the ruling class whenever there is a progressive candidate or ballot measure against them, we'll see which wins. In California, we have a pretty good example in 2012 of how the traditional anti-progressive messaging can be defeated. We had a tax that was being put on the state ballot by a number of public sector unions and the rest of the labor movement and a progressive coalition. And the sitting governor, Jerry Brown, you know, we were at that moment in time in the midst of the Great Recession following the crash in 2007-2008.
Right.
And the state was facing a huge budget deficit. And Brown knew that he needed to raise some money or we were going to have catastrophic cuts to public services. And so he proposed this mix of regressive and progressive taxes, but it was mostly going to raise taxes through increasing income taxes on lower brackets as well as the top brackets, and also through originally a 2-cent increase in the sales tax. So heavily regressive, while the Progressive Coalition, and at the time I was working for the California Federation of Teachers as the communications director, and we were devising messaging that focused very clearly on the need to pass a tax on the rich. And it was tax the rich for schools and services was the very simple, straightforward slogan. You say who you're going to tax, you're going to say for what purpose. And ultimately, we forced Brown to come to terms with us and merge his tax with ours. What we ultimately brought to the ballot, Proposition 30, was afflicted by a modest 0.25% sales tax. He insisted on keeping a tiny fraction of a sales tax because in his conversations with the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Roundtable, they had impressed upon him that there had to be shared sacrifice or they would oppose the measure. It couldn't just be a tax on the rich. And so we disagreed with that. We thought that the tax on the rich messaging was essential and was going to win, even if the Business Roundtable and the other bad guys in the ruling coalition, even if they came into it, we were still going to win. But in any event, when we came to the ballot, we had six out of the $7 billion a year we were going to raise with Prop 30 came out of the pockets of the rich, a small increase in their income tax top bracket. And the 0.25% sales tax was going to raise about $1 billion. So we passed that convincingly. It was 55-45.
Wow.
And 4 years, and it was a temporary tax, but 4 years later, we renewed it, and we renewed it until the year 2030. So it's still in place. And in 2016, when we renewed it, we dropped the sales tax. So it's a purely progressive tax, and it won both times. So the arguments against it, which you now see happening, of course, in New York,
yes,
same exact one, because it's yes, the one they always use, was that all the rich would flee California,
right,
and they would take all their jobs with them.
Mm-hmm.
While, in fact, what happened in California was in the couple of years following passage of Prop 30, California minted 10,000 new millionaires, and there were 1.2 million new jobs. So the teeth-gnashing fears that we were going to drive all of the jobs out of California simply did not come to pass. And it wouldn't come to pass in New York either, should this. Because, look, if you're making, there are 350,000 millionaires in New York City. If you are part of that elite group, where would you rather live? Would you rather live in New York or in Arizona or Nevada? I'm sure there are great things about both Nevada and Arizona, very attractive places. I did a lot of canvassing in both those places in the last presidential election. A lot of nice people, but they have problems with their public services because they don't have a proper tax base. And if you're a rich person and worried about, say, public, if you're worried about public services because you think it's good for society, that's all fine. That's good for your beliefs. But if you're also worried about your personal safety as a rich person, your personal safety is more under threat when you don't have a decent public health infrastructure.
That's for sure.
When you don't have, proper safe neighborhoods and, clean air, clean skies, clean water, and so on. So I very strongly doubt that in New York, the rich are going to leave if this passes.
Right. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. Keeping Democracy Alive, it's a group effort, people. Our guest today is Fred Glass, who's written an article, What California History Has to Say About the New York City Mayor's Race in 2025. And as with any big American city, there are problems which affect a lot of people in Manhattan. There's a few millionaires. There's a lot of, new buildings billionaires live in, but there are a lot of problems there. What has Mondani been saying about what the problems are and his proposed solutions that may sound a little bit similar?
So he's really just talking common sense in an era when political discourse is not ruled by common sense.
For sure.
And so that seems like he's an outlier when in fact he's simply being rational. He's saying that we need to make sure that rents are kept stable. He's saying that we need to have some competition with grocery store chains by city-run stores so that prices remain stable and can be lowered for working-class people. He wants buses to be free. Public transport should be just that, public transportation. If you want people to be able to get around, to get to work, to pick up their kids from childcare, to be able to go to the store and buy things, you should have free public transportation. It can be paid for. All of it can be paid for by slightly taxing people who have way more money than they know what to do with.
Right.
And the things that he's calling for, all of the support for working class people are things that we should have in our society if we want this to be a stable society. Increasingly over the last, I'd say since the Great Recession was really the dividing line, the neoliberal period of capitalism, where the market is supposed to run everything.
Yeah, just turn it loose.
It has been shown to be the neoliberal solutions for society have been shown to increasingly just make for great and growing inequality and cannot solve the problems that it creates. So if you have low taxes and you have poor public services, you're not going to be able to do things like support enough firefighting in a time of growing climate change, climate crisis, wildfires that need to be prevented, let alone fought. Floods that don't have enough federal workers to be able to ameliorate the problems, have weather systems that are in place to be able to warn people in time. If you want to cut and cut and cut public services because you've cut and cut and cut taxes on the rich, then you're going to end up with a society staggering from one crisis to another. And that's what we've got. And Mamdani and the democratic socialist solutions to these problems are the only ones that make sense. And the Democratic Party failed to do this in Kamala Harris's election campaign. They failed to center a working class message. And so as you, if you do not have a clear, effective message on the left on how to address the growing problems of our society, then you will have great fear on the other side rushing into the vacuum where that message should be. And you will have the, all the wrong forces in society, all the wrong people being pointed to by the right wing as the cause of the problems that people face. And people know that they face big problems, but often people don't know what the cause is or what the solution is. If you don't have clear answers to those problems, then the right wing will say it's the immigrants, it's trans people, it's bad books in school libraries. That's the cause of all our problems. And you need to have a unified message on the left that is able to say to people, no, the real problem in our society is great and growing economic inequality. Yes. And we address that by talking to the people who have the money and convincing them that they need to be able to share. Sharing is very basic. It's something we teach in kindergarten.
Yeah.
And it's something that the ruling class of first our neoliberal society over the last 50 years has completely forgotten. And by forgetting it, it's provided the open door now to sliding into fascism in America.
Yes, unfortunately. And people in New York City know Donald Trump. And Donald Trump hates Mondani and clearly is going to be, and, you know, he's called him a communist. And I don't think that's going to play well in New York City because people really know who the orange one is. Now, back in 1911, the voting age was, of course, 21. And in fact, in 2024, one of the reasons Democrats lost, they did very poorly with young people in 2024. In what's being called the Mondani effect, his win has spurred many thousands of young progressives to consider running for office. It's a group called Run for Something, a progressive political organization that helps younger candidates learn the ropes. What about the Mondani campaign, the Mondani win, resonates with young people where other political victories have not?
Well, besides the affordability crisis that young people face.
Yes, they do.
What he also has going for him, and now let's jump across the ocean, the Atlantic, to England for a comparison here. Mm-hmm. What he also has going for him is his very clear messaging around the need to end the slaughter in Gaza.
Yes.
And his calls to end the genocide. And so what that, of course, means in New York City is he faces the Zionist wing of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
Who
yes.
have assiduously and expensively promoted the lie that anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism.
Right.
And this is what felled Jeremy Corbyn in England when, with very similar politics to Mamdani's, he rose to the top of the Labour Party briefly and then was brought down by the right wing of his own party and the Tories, who were all on message about how he was anti-Semitic because he was anti-Zionist. And he did not respond effectively, and his wing of the party did not respond effectively to that charge. But the differences between then a few years ago and now is the war in Gaza.
Yes.
And this has opened the eyes of many Jews and also many young people who were passionate about Palestinian cause. That this was one of the main reasons that Kamala Harris lost. 5 to 7 million young people that had voted for Joe Biden sat on their hands for Kamala Harris around this issue. Because, I mean, I'm active in East Bay Democratic Socialists of America, DSA, and the young people were all on board, as was I, the movement for a ceasefire.
Yes.
So much so, though, for the young people who did not have a broader view of politics You know, they had a strong moral position around Palestine, but that didn't translate to the political vision to understand that there are two sides to a presidential campaign. One is international, on that Kamala Harris fell down.
Yes.
But there's also the national side. And everybody who was worried about authoritarianism and a slide to fascism in America should have been worried about Donald Trump becoming president and voting against him, even if that meant you were voting for, quote, the lesser of two evils because of the Palestine issue. So that's a long way of saying I think that Mamdani has a much stronger approach to this than Kamala Harris did.
Yes.
And particularly young people see that.
And as someone said a long time ago, if Republicans hoist something up the flagpole, but Democrats don't hoist anything up the flagpole for people to see, guess who wins? Well, you're in California, about 3,000 miles from New York City. What's your sense about the New York election and the future of what has been a politically dead party?
So the Democratic Party that's dead is the part that's controlled by the neoliberal wing.
Yes.
And Democratic Socialists have been making gains for the last 10 years since Bernie first ran. You know, this meant that there was a large cohort of young people that moved into DSA and transformed it into a viable force in politics in a number of places. So I think we're seeing the prime example of that now in New York City. New York has the largest chapter of DSA in the country, and it has elected a number of people to local and state office. Similarly, here in California, we have three dozen or so local elected officials who are DSA members. We have four city council members in Los Angeles. We're a force. And that's because of organizing on the ground, as Mamdani is doing, and also because of the message. Those two things together should be a signal to the Democratic Party leadership that they need to take seriously the idea of organizing on the ground, at least as much as going after billionaire money.
Oh, absolutely.
And they need to pay attention to the pro-worker messaging.
It's got to be a message. It's got to be something that people can understand and see, and just being the status quo and not Donald Trump.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
All we hear is Radio.
We are proud to announce exciting news. KBOO Community Radio has been voted the best radio station in Portland by Willamette.